Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Kay Puttock, together with my co-host, Gail Seeler. Hello, Gail. How was your Christmas?
Hi, Kay. My Christmas was good. It was pretty quiet, I think, by Christmas standards.
Me too. Yeah.
Which was nice. But I really enjoyed the snow. I was very happy to have a white Christmas.
It made the day nice for me. It was, yeah.
For our show today, first of all, we're going to be hearing from one of our regular phenology reports from our wildlife specialist, Pat Schlarbaum. This one's about trumpeter swans, and it's that time of year. It's the time for trumpeter swans. Then, appropriately enough, at this time of lifting the Cuban embargo, we'll also be hearing from two Iowa farmers about their recent trip to Cuba. So we'll get their impressions about Cuban society, Cuban farming methods, and particularly about some of the philosophy behind Cuban farming.
And finally, since it's the fourth Monday of the month, we'll be hearing a report from Allison Walter from the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau. Allison will be telling us what opportunities for excitement we can look forward to in Ames in this post-holiday period. But first, I'd like to welcome Pat Schlarbaum from the Wildlife Diversity Program of the Department of Natural Resources. Hello, Pat. It's good to see you again.
Thank you, Kay. It's so nice to be here. And for our phenology this morning, I thought I would bring people up to date on a big white bird that people are going to be seeing more and more of now that winter is kind of coming our way, are the trumpeter swans. We have a project underway where hopefully we'll repopulate the state with trumpeter swans. They were last nesting in 1884, so it's kind of a long time gone.
Mm-hmm.
Now that they're back, we want to encourage people to go out and see these big white birds. They're about a 30-35 pound North America's largest waterfowl, 6 to 7 foot wingspan, and they're just a joy to see in flight. And Rick, I think we've got a little audio I'd like to play, hence the name, Trumpeter Swans.
Yeah.
Well, that's the call.
And was that other noise there? Was that
water? There were some Canada geese in there, a little more muted.
In the background.
Yeah, the real mute. But that sonorous call is what was absent from the Iowa landscape. And we have a project underway that not only features trumpeter swans, but also the myriad of waterfowl that populate our wetlands. These birds are trumpeting the cause for wetlands. And we've got some spots here in central Iowa. Beamer's Pond is a great place, a great destination to go see and enjoy these birds. It's about 4 miles west of Webster City on Highway 20. But if you go up Highway 17 and then it jogs west, so it's at the intersection of Highway 17 and Highway 20. It's a little borrow pit area of 3 or 4 acres of water.
Mm-hmm.
And there's 150 trumpeter swans there currently, and maybe 100 more on the way.
So we have to thank that borrow pit.
Well, it's where they borrowed the dirt to make the overpasses. So it's kind of a wetland area that was a part of a modern landscape, if you will. But a great destination. We did not foresee these trumpeter swans overwintering in Iowa. And as there are more and more Canada geese that are going out and gleaning the waste grain from the agricultural enterprises, now the trumpeter swans are doing the same.
Wow.
So we really get to see something pretty special there. And they will be appearing at Ada Hayden also. Mm-hmm. Wherever there's open water, they require open water, and we like to promote the trumpeter swans as a native waterfowl species as opposed to the mute swans, which are here from Europe. And these mute swans are now kind of taking over some of our wetlands, and they drive off the native blue-winged teal and the mallards. They're kind of a disruption. Whereas the trumpeter swans fit right in.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, did I hear you saying, Gail, that you went to see them yesterday?
I went to see them yesterday. Yeah, I went last year and this year because I heard about it on KHOI. Otherwise, I would not have known about it. But, yeah, it's really spectacular. I encourage people to go. It's really amazing to hear them and to see them fly in. It's like you're watching these zooming jetliners come in and land.
Yeah. And they have huge feet.
Yeah.
And then they kind of put out the brakes.
To slow them down.
The landing is a whole other enterprise.
Yeah, like dropping their wheels or something.
Exactly. That's what it looks like.
And they're mated pairs, so they'll be bobbing their necks, these long, you know, their necks are like 3 feet long. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of special. But I do want to mention also January 30th, we're be hosting a swan soiree. Over the noon hour, from 10:30 to 1:30, and this is at Moffett Reservoir. Now, anybody that kind of knows Des Moines, it's in the far southwest corner of Des Moines. Look for Moffett Reservoir Road, and it's part of the Des Moines Water Works. And so, the director there, Bill Stowe, wants to trumpet the cause for wetlands and all the good things that these birds might inspire people to help with our water quality issues. So we'll be co-hosting an event with Des Moines Water Works, and that's January 30th.
From
10:30 to 1:30. Oh. Come out and have lunch. And there's a telephone number I'll list now, but we'll kind of give people a reminder. But the telephone number to learn more is 641-357-3517. And that'll put the listeners in touch with Dave Hoffman, who's a coworker that has been pretty instrumental in getting these birds back.
In the Department of Natural Resources.
He's with the Department of Natural Resources also. But we had our first successful nesting in 1998. So last year we had about 48 nesting pairs. So it's still relatively a growing enterprise.
Sure.
And we really want to encourage people to get out and hear and see these magnificent white birds.
Okay.
Back to Iowa.
And we will put this information on our website.
Yeah. And so. I don't think you mentioned, Pat, that when people should go, because if they go in the middle of the day, they won't see them.
Real good point. They leave right at about first light. There's a, flying away. But they return about 3:30 in the afternoon. So that's a real good point. Thank you, Gail, because if you go there, there's some resident swans and geese, but the big flights
are
like 3:30 until dusk.
Yeah,
and I really encourage people to go out and enjoy that.
That's the time to go.
Yeah, thank you so much, and that's our phenology for today.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Pat. It's always good to hear from you, and it's always good to hear about the wildness and diversity in Iowa. Yeah. And now we'll be hearing from someone else who cares about natural diversity, George Naylor, who, along with his partner, Patty Edwardson, is our next guest. They also care about diversity. But George, as a farmer growing corn and soybeans, comes at it from a different angle. It isn't in this interview. I did talk to him a bit about he's sort of against corn and soybeans. Why do you grow corn and soybeans? And he said, I have to sort of financially. But he doesn't approve of it. George has strong opinions about the subject of diversity and about modern farming methods here in Iowa. But in this interview, we'll mostly be sticking to the experience that he and Patty had in their recent trip to Cuba. I should say that I came at this interview as someone who knows very little about farming. I'm a Londoner by birth. If some of the questions I ask seem elementary to Iowans, let's hope that at least some of our listeners will have the same kind of questions. So let's hear that interview with George and Patty now. I'm very glad to welcome local farmers, George Naylor and Patty Edwardson, who farm, where is it, George?
Well, it's about an hour west. Our town is Sherdan, Iowa.
And they've just come back from a trip to Cuba where they were attending two agriculture-related conferences, which they'll be telling us about. But first of all, I want to tell you a bit about George and Patty. George Naylor, some of you who've read The Omnivore's Dilemma will know that there's a whole section about him in that book. And I'll get him to talk to us just a little bit about that in a minute. He's also on the board for the Center for Food Safety and the board of the Non-GMO Project. And his partner, Patty, is on the board of Women and Food and Agriculture Network. Well, welcome again.
Yes, thanks.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, why don't you tell us, why did Michael Pollan have a whole section of his book about you, George?
I was president of the National Family Farm Coalition, and we had read an article that he had written in the New York Times Magazine about how he had bought a small calf and traced it through the food system, and the calf ended up in a great big industrial feedlot eating a lot of corn. And so he wondered, well, why are they doing that? And his conclusion was because corn was so cheap. And so we wanted to make him understand that the corn didn't need to be so cheap, that the original purpose of the New Deal farm programs, which we haven't had now for, well, since the early 1950s, was to make sure that corn wasn't so cheap and that we weren't using our resources to produce crops that we didn't need. And so
Now, wait a minute, just to backtrack a bit.
Yeah.
Why is it producing crops you don't need to feed corn to a calf?
Well, as he pointed out, cattle were really, they evolved to eat grass.
Right.
And so it's only modern technology that allows them to eat lots of corn and put on weight.
So you get marbled beef, which is very bad for your heart. Anyway.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yes, it's not natural at all. But that's the way the whole system works, is if you can produce something cheaper, that's the answer. And so the New Deal farm program would have said, well, we shouldn't be wasting resources producing corn and letting our soil be eroded in the process, raising corn to feed cows. And in more modern times, it means we've been using a lot more chemicals and fertilizer than we used to also.
Rather than just having the cows on a pasture, which
right.
wouldn't need to be plowed or...
Right, yes, that... yeah. If they were on pasture and were being fed hay, it would take a lot less fertilizer and a lot fewer chemicals, if any at all.
But the beef wouldn't be marbled, but people's hearts would be better.
Well, you'd be surprised. We bought some grass-fed beef from a farmer, John Jetson, last year here in Iowa, and it was as tender and tasty as any beef I've ever eaten in my life. So I don't think it's necessarily true that grass-fed is tough or not marbled. It's just that it's cheaper for big corporations to raise beef if you throw them in a big feedlot and feed corn to them.
Okay. So back to the book here.
And so when Michael Pollan came out to my farm, you know, he looked and see how I raised corn, how I produced corn, and also then we talked about the alternative policy that we could have so that the livestock, like cattle, would be on small farms and ranches instead of in big feedlots.
Now, you do, in fact, raise corn and soybeans.
So oh, yeah.
Traditional crops for Iowa.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you're still doing that.
Yeah, I am, although I'm transitioning to some to organic with the help of my partner, Patty Edwardson, here. And also, she's been investigating the production of fruits and vegetables. And we also planted a 200-acre apple orchard for making organic hard apple cider.
Uh-huh.
That's just started now.
Now, so. As an Englishwoman, that interests me, hard cider.
Yeah, we'll need your taste buds to get for taste tests.
Okay, let's move on to the conferences in Cuba. There were two associated conferences, I believe. Why don't you tell us what they were?
Yeah, sir, you want to?
The first week we went to a conference called Fifth International Conference on Agroecology, and it was sponsored by La Via Campesina International and the National Association of Small Farmers in Cuba. And the second week, we stayed for a second week, it was in the same place, also sponsored by the same organizations, but it was more of a course in agroecology methodology, farmer-to-farmer method.
Now, the first one you mentioned, Via Campesina, that means the life of a farmer, right?
Yeah, kind of.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's the peasant's way.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So a campesino, is it a farmer or a peasant farmer?
A peasant,
farmer?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. And that's an international
yes,
organization.
Yes, they actually have millions of farmers around the world that are involved in those different groups that are part of the movement.
Okay, and the other one was a National Association of Small Farmers of Cuba.
Right.
And you mentioned to me before when we were talking that people from 27 different countries were there.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, and that's because one of the goals of Via Campesina is to promote agroecological farming. because it really means that not only are you, the farmers going to be more ecological, but they're going to be more independent and not have to invest in chemicals and machinery that can also put them in jeopardy of losing their farms and going broke. So it's a very important thing, and it also has a community aspect to it, so that as like in this farmer-to-farmer business, it's all about farmers sharing information amongst each other.
Mm-hmm. Patty, what would you say were the highlights of the conference for you?
We had just a wonderful time. We met so many different people, some very passionate people from all over the world that were working in their countries on the issues of biodiversity, saving seeds, food sovereignty. It was just a wonderful group of people. And then, of course, we went to visit farms in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very diverse. They were family farms, most of they were small farms, and they were in the process of doing agroecological methods. There was a whole variety of methods that they could, in a sense, choose from. So visiting those farms was just a wonderful experience.
Now, there was a sort of sharing out of the land after the Cuban Revolution, wasn't there?
Mm. Yeah, there was an agrarian reform,
mm-hmm.
because before, like most Latin American countries, vast estates that were owned by very rich people dominated the landscape, and their agriculture was dominated by that kind of agriculture where most of the people just ended up being
peons, I guess.
Yeah, peons on the land. And so after the agrarian reform, land was given to peasants, and farmers were encouraged to create co-ops.
So these were small farms of about how many acres?
Well, there are actually some of the what we did is we divided up into groups. There were about 260 participants this first week of the conference, and we divided up into smaller groups. And our group went to one region. The regions that we did not get to were the urban farms. So there's actually a small garden in urban farms that are part of this agroecological movement also.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's sort of kind of a big range of sizes of farms.
But,
the largest would have been...
Oh, I don't know, but there... Yeah, I mean, it's pretty typical for... a small farm to be anywhere from 2 to 10 acres or 20 acres.
That's really small.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right, yeah. But they're raising fruits and vegetables.
Right.
With something that's higher value than just like corn and soybeans.
So an urban farm would be typically how much? Just a backyard?
Well, I would think so, yeah. Although there would, I think they would have some, open space in the cities that are bigger than that.
Okay. So where you might have village greens, or that might be put over to agriculture.
Right. You see, when the Soviet Union collapsed, the trade with the Soviet Union collapsed, and the Soviet Union had provided technological inputs like chemicals and fertilizer to Cuba's agriculture. And so Cuba had to make an abrupt change in how they were producing their food, and because they could not afford to import much food. So that's one of the reasons why agroecology became the norm in Cuba. And so it's been a push from the government and like the small farmers organization to encourage that kind of production for quite a while now, basically ever since the Soviet Union collapsed.
So there was out of that hardship came something good.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's the silver lining. I mean, same way with the embargo with the United States. You know, we haven't had trade with Cuba for many, many years. And so Cuba, had to become more self-reliant. And so there's a lot of creativity went into that. And we saw that the way a lot of the farmers had to use really old machinery and things like that. But they've, learned a lot about how to grow things ecologically. And how
become
to,
more self-sufficient.
Yeah, more self-sufficient.
Yes. So what were the highlights for you, George?
Well, I'd say when you see these small farms, it's like typical. You'd think, well, gee, how can anybody make a living on 10 acres? But you see now with the agroecological thinking that goes into it, they're encouraged to have a diverse production of different kinds of crops and figure out how to have one crop complement another one and how they can bring livestock into their farm production so that they have manure. So the diversity of the farming was just a wonderful thing to see.
So it was more like what I'd think of as an old-fashioned farm. When you read these kids' farm books, there's a cow, a goat.
Right.
And all sorts of different things, interesting things to see.
Yes, yeah, that's correct. And then it's interesting to see how they have farm co-ops that help them market their products. And then also that if they do have to buy other inputs, the co-op can buy that at a cheaper price and distribute it in a good way. They're not beholden to some company like Monsanto or a co-op like we have in the United States that isn't actually being run for the benefit of the farmers.
Okay, now you said crops that complement one another. I'm sure a lot of people know what that means, but others won't. Could you explain that?
Well, some of the things that they were doing was called intercropping. So we'd see rows of trees, fruit trees that had been planted, mango, guava, some coconut trees.
Oh, lovely tropical trees.
Lots of banana trees. And then between, in the alleyways between the rows, they had beans growing. And then also, in the vegetable production, they would have a couple of rows of lettuce surrounded by or bordered by onions. So they wouldn't have just a whole monocrop of field.
Right.
They had a lot of different things in that smaller space.
Right. Which helps prevent insect infestation.
Yeah, right.
And what other advantages does it have?
Well, that's one of the main things, but also then by being able to have a different crop rotation, you can break up some of the disease problems in the soil and like you said, the insect problems and disease problems. Some crops actually will repel certain insects. So if you can get those intermingled with your other crops, that'll be a help right there.
Uh-huh. Well, like I suppose onions.
Yeah.
Presumably hot peppers would help repel insects,
right.
Things like
well, yeah,
that.
Well, yeah, that's one of the things we heard from the farmers was that they were always investigating making concoctions from, native plants that they knew, the bugs didn't like or that they were very bitter or very hot or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And then they would mix up a concoction and make that into a homemade spray.
Right.
To keep the bugs off their plants.
Something to make it stick, like honey, or what would they use to make it stick?
Yeah, or maybe molasses or sugar. Yeah,
anyway. Well, I remember when I used to be very hot on organic gardening, I used to make some of those mixes.
The farmers were all engaged in various aspects of experimentation and using their own knowledge. That's one thing about agroecology. It's not a top-down thing. It's not a thing like much of our extension here in the United States where extension says, we've got this new scientific breakthrough and you guys all ought to use this chemical or whatever, It's more like, we need science, But on the other hand, we want to see it work and we want to blend that with our knowledge of what works in this area and with our crops.
Right.
So that's why things do actually change in their farming.
So that is very similar to Iowa's Practical Farmers of Iowa, where farmers teach farmers.
Right.
And it comes from a horizontal methodology of teaching from, what was the gentleman's name?
Yeah, Paulo Freire, who's a... he's a famous person from Brazil that... developed a whole methodology for teaching
the
people.
The Pedagogy of the Oppressed.
Yes, the Pedagogy of the Oppressed, yeah. So
that's the name of one of his books.
They realize what's going on.
Right. And as I recall, it's a long time since I've read that book. I read this actually when I was studying education. This is something that teachers were meant to consider and discuss. The idea is that basically you talk to people where they're at, and if you want to teach really oppressed people, and he was thinking about, I guess, peons. Well, how do you pronounce that word, peon?
Well, I don't know. Peons, I would say in Spanish, probably.
On these great big estates, how do you get to them and teach them, to read? How can you make that important to them, for example? Mm-hmm. Well, maybe they want to write a letter to their landlord, something like that, where you get to them where they're at. That was the gist of that book, as I recall. But as I say, it's many years since I've read it.
Right, yeah.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I'm Kay Partuk, one of your hosts today. I'm here with my co-host, Gail Seeler, and Gail, we'll get back to the rest of that recorded interview soon, but I wanted to take a break just now to ask you about Paulo Freire, who we were just talking about there in that interview. As I said to George and Patty, it's years since I read this book, The Pedagogy of the Oppressed, but you teach in the School of Education, you teach about Freire, I believe. You teach teachers, and you teach about Freire, which I was a bit surprised to learn because I thought of it as a 60s thing. It was the 60s when I read it. So you're probably much more familiar with Freire's work than I am. Why do you think the Cubans and George and Patty met were so interested in his ideas?
Yes, we do still teach a lot about from Paulo Freire's writings, and including the Pedagogy of the Oppressed and other more current educators who've continued to use his work. So he's very much still in use and informs a lot of the work, especially in the kind of work that I do in the multicultural education course that we teach, that I happen to be involved in. So yeah, he plays a big role still in education among some people. But it was interesting to hear them talk about, George and Patty talk about his work in connection with the farmers that they were talking with. I guess an important idea of Freire's was this idea of conscientization in Portuguese, which he spoke. It sounds a little different, but that's the way it's been translated into English. Conscientization, which means to come to consciousness. And what he meant by that was developing a critical awareness of one's own reality and the understanding that one is oppressed and how they're being oppressed. And to do that, which he thought was critical to bringing about social change, was you had to have that critical awareness first. But to do that required literacy, both the ability to read and to write. And he considered literacy very broadly. He's used the phrase reading and writing the word, but also reading and writing the world. So the learning was very much embedded with the context and the social situation that the people were in. So I can see that connecting with the work that's being done with the farmers there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Another interesting thing is that the actual literacy campaign in Cuba, which happened after the revolution during some of the first years of Castro's regime, I guess you could say, or Castro's coming into power, there was this national literacy campaign where they trained thousands and thousands of young people to go out into the countryside and to raise the literacy of the people who were living there, the campesinos. And part of that was not just learning to read, but also this conscientization that they would become aware of their context, aware of their situation.
Consciousness raising,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So that they could become part of the movement to bring about a different kind of system. And I think that meant an agricultural changes in the agricultural system as well, because the agricultural system had been controlled basically by outsiders up to that point, right. Basically by the U.S. They were mm-hmm. making millions off the sugar cane plantations and mm-hmm. so on. So that changed. But another interesting thing that came from the literacy campaign was that it brought Cubans from the city, young people from the city, went out into the countryside to teach. And the literacy rate in the countryside was estimated at that time to be almost 42%, the illiteracy rate in the countryside. And the nationwide illiteracy rate dropped to 4% in about 1 year.
Wow.
So this was really, really effective, unlike, you know, almost any other country in the world. In terms of raising the literacy and decreasing the illiteracy. But the other thing that it did was it created a solidarity between the urban people who were trained to go out and teach and the people who lived out in the rural areas. And it was very much a learning from each other, as they talked about, a horizontal learning situation, not one person having all the knowledge and giving it to the other.
Right.
Freire called that a banking model of education, and he was very much against that it really needed to be about everyone learning from each other. Mm-hmm. So one of the offshoots of the literacy campaign was a really solidarity creating context in Cuba, because the people from the city learned from the people in the countryside and the people in the countryside learned from the people in the city. And they say it was a really important force in moving the revolution and the transformative change forward at that time.
Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate that, because, as I say, I had a very sketchy memory.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's get back to the rest of the recorded interview with George Naylor and Patty Edwardson about their trip to Cuba.
One of the things that the Small Farmers Association of Cuba does is really involve women in their organization. So most of the people of the organization that we had contact with were women. Anyway, the farmers themselves mostly were men. Mm-hmm. But the women were a part of the organization, and they're a very large part of the organization, important part. And the family dynamics was very important to this organization.
Right. And that's true of Via Campesina. Across the world, they intend to elevate women's participation in the organization and in farming and making decisions.
Well, that obviously would appeal to me.
Yeah, well, it should appeal to everybody.
Right.
It's kind of interesting for me since I've sort of, it was been a dream come true actually to visit Cuba because I know they ostensibly have had a socialist society, and so I didn't really know what to expect when I saw Cuba. And, of course, any time I go anywhere, it turns out what I witness is completely different than I had imagined. But in this case, I was basically pleasantly surprised. Of course, you don't see the massive income inequality. That's the most obvious difference. There, you see a lot of modest houses and very few really nice houses. And you don't see what I saw in Guatemala or Nicaragua, where some of the nicer houses have brick walls around the outside with glass bottles.
Oh, to keep people out. Yeah.
Yeah, stuck in the top and then broke off so that people can't get over the fence, you know. And the other thing we didn't see hardly any police officers or military around. I thought maybe, you know, the image of a police state or something right. might be apparent, but that was never apparent. And we never saw people arguing or, you know, having disagreements on the street or anywhere. So it was quite a surprise.
People were basically behaving themselves without police around and very little income inequality, so very little motivation for people to steal or...
Oh, yes. Yeah. We were perfectly comfortable walking the streets of Havana or the small town where we were visiting. One of the things that seems so striking to us is travel in a bus. But every highway has every kind of mode of transportation you could imagine. People walking, bicycles, horse-drawn carriages, buses, trucks, and everybody just respecting each other going around, no road rage or anything like that.
Yeah.
If you're in a bus or a fast car and you've got a horse-drawn carriage in front of you, no banging on the horn.
No, right. Yeah, right.
Now, when I think of Cuban agriculture, I think of sugarcane. Was there much of that still?
Well, there was some. I don't think we saw any really huge acreages of that. I think there probably are some. There is some of the land that's still farmed by the government, and I would suspect that something like that is connected to a big sugar processing plants and things like that.
Right.
We saw some smaller plots of sugarcane, and what we were told is that a lot of the land in Cuba not in production right now. The government is actually giving some land to people who want to farm. One farm that we visited had mostly livestock, but his farm had been a part of a sugarcane plantation years ago that had been abandoned. So when he was given this land, he had to go in and chop out all of the invasive plants that had grown up there instead. Mm-hmm. And he now has a farm of his own, and he was very happy.
Which was basically given to him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have a deal where it's called usufruct. It's like a legal word that means that they have the land almost in perpetuity as long as they keep farming it in a good way.
Okay.
Right. So it's not doesn't become a speculative commodity or anything
like
that.
So they have the use of it, but they couldn't necessarily pass it on to their children unless their children farmed it.
Yeah, generally they can pass it on to their children, but they're not intended to be sold, you know, in a speculative market, for instance.
But the child couldn't take it and sell it, for example.
No, right. No,
it's always they farm it.
Yeah, it always has to be farmed, used in a socially responsible manner.
Mm-hmm.
Here in the United States, we have something that's been developed. It's called the U.S.-Cuba Agroecology Network. So some folks from the E.F. Schumacher Center.
That's
I think
a
it's
small
called.
Is beautiful.
Right? Yeah, small is beautiful, right. Yeah, they've developed this network so that people in the United States that have any expertise or interest in agriculture, like farmers, can belong to this network, and then we will be networking with people in Cuba to encourage exchange of ideas and support, you know, just generally. So if people want to go online and look that up, there might be opportunities for them to get involved. It's called the U.S.-Cuba Agroecology Network. Their website is agroecologynet.org.
Did anything you learn while you were in Cuba, do you think you can bring that home to your own farm?
Well, I think the spirit of experimenting and sharing ideas with other farmers, which we've already been doing in Practical Farmers of Iowa, yeah, that's a really good thing to be.
And also they talk about how agroecology has been proven to be more resilient, especially in the face of climate change. Mm. When hurricanes or drought have hit Cuba, their farmers have been able to recover a lot faster. Here in Iowa, when we depend on just two crops, that's not very resilient.
Right. So if something like a drought hits, for example, if you've got lots of different crops, mm-hmm. they'll be affected differently. So you won't have a
right.
monolithic disaster.
Right. Yeah, correct.
Of course, the other thing, in talking about diversity and resilience on their farms, is the variety of crops. They save their own seeds in many cases, and they teach each other to do that. And so they honor that kind of ancestral knowledge and continue that kind of biodiversity.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. I've been talking to George Naylor and Patty Edwardson, who've just about 2 weeks ago got back from a trip to Cuba where they were studying farming and attending two associated conferences for small farmers.
Well, thanks, Kay.
Thank you both.
Yeah,
very much.
Thank you, Kay.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we've just been hearing an interview with Iowa farmers George Naylor and Patty Edwardson, who've recently returned from a trip to Cuba. But now I'd like to welcome our final guest on today's show, Allison Walter of the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau. Welcome, Allison.
Good morning.
You made it here through the beginnings of our snowstorm.
Yes.
Thank you.
It's starting to come down, definitely.
Great. And as usual, you're going to tell our listeners about many things that are going on this
yes.
month. And I think you mentioned that you would start with some snow, winter-related kinds
right.
of activities. It's
yes.
a perfect day to learn about those.
It is a perfect day to learn about those. And, you know, we've got a little time here with no school, so if you're looking for things to do and keep the family busy, or you've got family still in town, you know, it might be a good day to explore things to do around the community. So a few fun, different ideas. Creative Spirits is a business here in town that does painting workshops, and they will help you create a painting. They have some original artwork, and then their instructors will walk you through recreating your own version of that same artwork. And everyone comes out a little bit different because everyone interprets things a little bit differently. So they have a studio here in town over in West Ames, but they also work with Della Vitti, and they'll have workshops set up there where you can come in and enjoy Della Vitti and do a little painting, and also out at Snooze Hill Winery. So you can set up your own personal time with them, or they have some workshops and things already pre-scheduled if you want to do that. And really, they'll do it for all ages, but it is a good family event or a girlfriend's night out or something like that. And speaking of Della Vitti, they do game nights, so you can go in and enjoy the wine and the spirits there, as well as taking advantage of their game night activities. And they have, in case you're not familiar with Della Vitti and how it works, that it's a self-serve wine bar. And you can choose from over 48 different wines, and they have these, they're called Napa Valley Technology Wine Stations. Mm. And you can choose either a taste or a half glass or a full pour. Right. And so it's a fun way to try some different wines and learn a little bit about them. They also do wine tastings and beer tastings, and I think they actually do scotch tastings as well. Mm-hmm. So you can check out their calendar of events, but they are open afternoon and evening mm-hmm. Anytime to just stop in. And you buy a little card, right. a little looks like a credit card that you stick in the machine, and it keeps track of how much you've spent. And
right, it's quite a cool system. It's fun.
And you
get to taste different kinds of wine. Yeah. And right, you can take a little bit of taste of one and see if you like it, and then get the full pour or the half glass. And that's right here on Main Street in Ames.
Mm-hmm. And you say game nights. What kind of games?
They have just lots of board games and card games, and it's just a wonderful atmosphere. Even if it's just you and a couple of friends and you just want to start your own game, you know, they have chess and checkers and backgammon and some nice tables, and then they do some organized things as well.
Okay.
So you can cross-country ski and snowshoe in the area. Jack's Outdoor Gear and Skunk River Cycles both have rentals available. Mm-hmm. But if you've got your own, you can just head out to McFarland Park or Hickory Grove Park, and they've got some wonderful trails to get outdoors. And seems like this might be a perfect opportunity
I have to interject something about snowshoeing.
Yes.
My husband takes our dog out in all weathers, and he went out one winter recently with his snowshoes. It was gone so long, I called the sheriff.
Oh, dear.
And the sheriff said, nobody should be out in this weather. And I said, you tell him that. Yeah. And just as the sheriff was about to set out to look for me, the car pulled into the driveway with a dog in it.
Wonderful. Well, it's wonderful exercise, and it's a great way to get outdoors and enjoy nature. And and I know that Story County Conservation has some snowshoeing workshops coming up. I think the first one is this week, the 28th. So, so you can get out and get a little instruction and use their snowshoes if you don't have your own. So it's a great way to enjoy the outdoors.
You tend to think you can just snowshoe by nature, but it does need some.
It is. It's a little tricky to walk in snowshoes. So it does help to get a little instruction.
Allison, do you know if McFarland or any of the other parks have groomed cross-country trails?
I believe McFarland and Hickory Grove both have some marked groomed trails. Okay. Yes. And I also think Vinkner Golf Course, a lot of people head over there to do cross-country skiing.
Okay.
So, yes. How about a little bowling or arcade games or laser tag? You can do all of those at Perfect Games.
Oh.
And they have 24 lanes of bowling, and they have two floors in their laser tag arena. And they've also got a pizza restaurant and a sports bar in there. So lots of fun times can be had there. Watch the big game because they've got lots of TVs. And so kind of keep get a little exercise bowling and keep everybody happy with a variety of activities there.
And that's in West Ames.
Over in West Ames. Perfect Games on Dickinson, I think it is. Ryman Gardens has a fabulous assortment of things going on. One thing that they're doing this winter again, which I think is fun, is Saturday morning movies. And it is, I think, 10 o'clock on Saturday mornings. A great family-friendly atmosphere. 10 o'clock. And they'll be showing Mary Poppins this Saturday.
Oh.
They'll be showing Inside Out and Toy Story. So it's a great, fun time. They keep the kids busy, and you can wander through the conservatory if you'd like. And they will allow you to bring some snacks in, and they'll also have some available, popcorn and things. So great way to enjoy
Ryman Gardens. Yeah, I've never seen Mary Poppins. Maybe I should go
there
see
you
that.
Go. They're doing winter photography classes. They're doing their crafty cocktail nights where they'll bring in an artist to help you with a craft.
This is all at Ryman Gardens.
All at Ryman Gardens this month, yep. and a floral design class. So always lots to see, and you know it's kind of fun to see the gardens in the winter as well as in the summer. And you can always go into the butterfly wing, and it's nice and warm and humid in there, and tropical feeling. So.
But you know one thing about the butterfly wing, you should go when the sun's out, because when the sun's not out, the butterflies just aren't flying
around. It's much quieter in there, but even a little bit of sun gets moving, and and it is. It's a wonderful place on a cold day to go in and warm up. Cold sunny day. There you go. You know, you can always get out and enjoy some hot cocoa or coffee. We've got a wide variety of coffee shops in the community. In Campus Town, there's Arcadia Bakery, Dunkin' Donuts, Stomping Grounds, Starbucks. There's a new Starbucks in the Campus Town area, as well as the one on Lincoln Way, Cafe Baudelaire. So, and some great shops in the Campus Town area. A couple of new Cyclone shops, Campus Spirit and Barefoot Outfitters both have lots of Cyclone gear available. And Dollar Days will be coming up on Main Street here in January, the last weekend, the 28th through the 30th. And so that's when all the stores pull out their special deals, the clothing stores and the shoe stores, sort of the final days of their clearance sale, so you can get some really great deals. I know Emmerhoff's is starting their shoe sale this morning, and then by Dollar Days, they'll be hoping to be giving away those last pair of shoes for a real bargain. So mark your calendars for Dollar Days, January 28th through the 30th, and that's on Main Street in the Main Street Cultural District. Seven Oaks Recreation. We're finally getting some snow. They struggled earlier in the winter, but now with between their snow making and the snow we've gotten in the last few days, you can go downhill skiing, snowboarding, and tubing. And Seven Oaks Recreation is just past Boone on Highway 30, right before the river. Right.
They make snow there.
They have amazing. I read hundreds of thousands of gallons of water that they go through making snow every year. But
what would winter tubing be?
The big inner tubes, and they actually have a rope that will pull you up the hill, so you don't have to crawl the whole way up with your inner tube. And then it's like sledding,
like
but
sledding.
It's a big inner tube, bigger
like a tractor inner tube.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Oh wow!
It's really fun, and you bounce because it's an inner tube, and just fly down the hill.
This is let's do a station identification and say who we're talking with. This is KHOI, Community Radio in the heart of Iowa, and we have with us today Allison Walter from the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau, and she's telling us about things to do in this month.
Yeah.
And just to let people know also that we'll have a link to your website, which has all of this information on it. So if you the listener misses anything in the details of what you're saying, they can look for it on our website, which can link to your website, or they can go directly to
their website. Their website is Visit Ames.
Right.
Okay.
VisitAmes.com.
Easy to remember.
Yep. And we send out a newsletter. I'm actually – all of the things that I'm mentioning today are in our monthly newsletter. And so if you'd like to receive that newsletter, you can – there's a link on our website, or you can call our office. We'd be happy to put you on the list. And it's just a great way to be informed and keep in mind that there are great things to do in the community. And we'll just – gladly remind you of those kinds of things every once in a while with our newsletter.
Maybe you should tell us about some New Year's Eve ideas.
Oh, yes. We do have New Year's Eve coming up. And one that's we've mentioned at the beginning, Della Vitti, they're having a wonderful New Year's Eve party. And there will be some champagne as well as appetizers and, of course, wine. And they will start at 5 o'clock on New Year's Eve. And they'll have music by Brian Congdon, wonderful acoustic guitar. And they'll go through the evening there at Della Vitti. And then also the Ames JCs are sponsoring a New Year's Eve party. And they'll be out at the Holiday Inn Conference Center on University Boulevard. And they'll have one of my favorite bands, the Burnin' Sensations, will be playing. And the party starts about 8 o'clock on New Year's Eve out at the Holiday Inn with the Ames JCs. And then we also have a New Year's Eve party at Hotel Paty, which is over in Perry.
Oh, wonderful place.
And they do a nice evening with food and dancing. Another great band, Planet Passengers, will be playing for them. And they've got some hotel packages, so you can check and see if there's any rooms left. But they'll include a prime rib dinner and an appetizer reception, as well as the party favors and the party with the band that evening. So that's Hotel Paty over in Perry. It's a great way to spend the evening.
I just put in a plug for the Hotel Paty. Yes. All of the rooms are themed differently.
Yes.
And my husband told me there was a surprise, and as I walked into the room, I said, oh, this is a William Morris room.
Oh, fun.
I recognized the artwork.
And yes. Yeah, it is. It's a beautiful place, and like you say, every room is different theme. There's a Styx room. I stayed in the Needlepoint room one time, and everything in it was Needlepoint.
You know, and it's an old hotel.
Old
is that
hotel,
right?
That's been redone. New owners within the last couple of years that have just done a wonderful, wonderful job. It's a real treasure for the area to have. Yes. And of course, we'll have lots of Iowa State athletics over the next few days. There is a men's basketball game on Wednesday evening, and the women take on Oklahoma State on Saturday at 2 o'clock. A few things to keep you busy over the holiday weekend as well. We also have the Madrigal Dinners coming up later in January at Iowa State, and that's in the Memorial Union. And the ISU Music and Theater Program puts those on January 15th and 16th. And they use the Great Hall of the Memorial Union, so it's a perfect setting for the 17th century Madrigal Dinner, and lots of candlelight and ambiance, and they'll have the full royal court and the dancers and the jesters and the musicians. It's a wonderful, wonderful experience.
And that's open to anyone. Anyone can purchase
tickets,
a ticket.
Tickets available. We talked a little bit about bowling at the Perfect Games, but, you know, you can also bowl at the Memorial Union. They've got a few lanes down there in the lower level of the Memorial Union, and they've also got some great arts and crafts classes at the Workspace and Cyclone Cinema. They always are showing movies. And also later this month will be Varieties, which is the ISU talent show performance that the student groups put on. So those performances will be coming up here soon. And you can always go ice fishing. Hickory Grove Park and Ada Hayden allow ice fishing on the lake. Again, you can get lots of supplies for that out at Jack's out in West Ames. Okay. And ice skating.
You can rent the supplies that you have to buy.
I believe those you probably have to buy. Okay. I don't know that they rent the huts and the they've got all kinds of paraphernalia.
A lot of gear
to go ice fishing. Yeah, got to stay warm. And you can do a little ice skating, too, of course.
So where can you go outdoor ice skating?
I was going to suggest indoor ice skating at the at the Ames ISU Ice Arena.
Ice Arena. Right. Are there places for outdoor?
My neighbors make a little.
Yes. Exactly. Okay. I do think McFarland Park, though, also on the pond. responded.
Oh, okay.
They'll
right,
keep an eye on that. So
that's
you
good
can,
to know.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think we're about out of time.
Just about.
Yeah. And I could talk for more, but no, there's lots to do. So you can always think of our website as a great resource, visitames.com, to find out what's going on today, but also just, you know, kind of look for some great ideas of other things to do.
Wonderful. You always bring us great ideas. I always learn a lot about things I want to do next.
Well, good.
Yeah. Thank you very much,
Oh,
Allison.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This has been Local Talk, where we explore the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm Gail Seiler, one of your hosts today, and I'd like to take this opportunity to thank all of you who've contributed to our recent fund drive. Your generous contributions make Local Talk and all our other shows possible. Today, we heard about trumpeter swans from Pat Schlarbaum of the Wildlife Diversity Program of the Department of Natural Resources. We also heard from Patty Edwardson and George Naylor, farmers from Chirden, Iowa, who recently traveled to Cuba to attend two farming-related conferences. And finally, our last guest was Allison Walter of the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau, who just finished telling us about things to do in winter and January around the area.
Our theme song, which you're hearing right now, is Backtrack It by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you'd like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878 or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. You can also listen to this show and all our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. You can find today's show on our homepage as soon as our webmaster is able to post it. KHOI is now streaming live online at khoifm.org, where you'll also find an archive of shows. Please remember that you, as listener, are the most important part of Local Talk. Your participation as an audience and your generous donations help make it all possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.